Thank you very much for that introduction. Lord Bingham has been conspicuously active in his so-called retirement. Perhaps most notably, his Grotius lecture in London last month, in which he raised the serious doubts as to the legality under international law of Britain's invasion of Iraq. But this is hardly the path of a man who's seeking a quiet retirement. The Guardian newspaper, to complement Graham's Times reference, The Guardian, not traditionally known for its unstinting praise of the judiciary, said of that speech, the Grotius lecture speech, in a recent editorial, "When Lord Bingham speaks of the law, it's always a good idea to listen." And I'd added, and I'm sure His Lordship will be delighted to hear this, that Lord Bingham is not just any old lawyer. He is the most senior judge of the modern era, regarded as many by many as its finest legal mind. So, for me, it is a particular pleasure and an honour to respond to Lord Bingham's speech today. And I might add an opportunity that I am especially grateful for, given that his 17 years occupying the top three legal positions in the UK coincide, unfortunately for me, almost exactly with the length of time that I've lived away from the United Kingdom. What I propose to do in this short response is to engage in a little compare and contrast of the Australian and the UK situations, and draw out what I think are some of the salient aspects of the debate that we must have here, and that the UK continues to have in respect not only of the existing Human Rights Act, but also the possibility alluded to by Lord Bingham of a United Kingdom Bill of Rights in the future. So first of all, looking at the United Kingdom, it's curious, despite the legacy of modern-day human rights thinking left by the European Enlightenment thinkers, and in that number there were a very good proportion of English, Irish and Scots, the Anglo-Celtic politico-legal tradition in respect of rights is marked by an ambivalence and sometimes by antagonism, both on the left and the right of politics. The left has probably the longest tradition of opposition. Karl Marx saw rights as the oppressive instruments of the bourgeoisie, and the Labour stalwart Harold Laski, whose socialism was influenced as much by John Stuart Mill as by Marx, thought that rights potentially stood in the way of the redistributive designs of big government. Doubters on the right of politics included the Irishman Edmund Burke, who saw them as the dangerous tools of revolution, and he was reflecting at the time on his impressions of the American and the French revolutions. And Margaret Thatcher saw them as, at best, unnecessary, and at worst, obstacles to the rolling back of the state. Interestingly, precisely the opposite to Lasky's objections a generation before her. But even today, 10 years after its enactment, the debate over the Human Rights Act still rages. For example, in 2006, Douglas Cameron, a Conservative MP who formerly sat on Parliament's very own Joint Committee on Human Rights, submitted a report to the committee and to his colleagues to consider, entitled "Why the Human Rights Act Must Be Scrapped." Even more colourful contributions to the debate were prompted by a judgment handed down last month restricting media revelations of such matters as the recreational drug use of celebrities or the sexual peccadilloes of Formula One supremo Max Mosley. In response to this judgment, Paul Darcy, the shy and retiring editor of the Daily Mail, was moved to call the Human Rights Act wretched, the relevant judge arrogant and amoral, and for good measure he bemoaned the inexorable and insidious incursions into our liberties by the Act's privacy provisions. Perhaps most significantly, however, even the political parents of the Act have decided on some counselling as the legislation heads towards its teenage years. Earlier this week, Jack Straw, now the Lord Chancellor and Justice Secretary, indicated his intention to proceed with an overhaul of the Human Rights Act to, and I quote, "wrest back its reputation as a charter for criminals." In Australia, we have inherited the same, or at least some of the same, ambivalence and antagonism, and also on both sides of politics. On the right, somewhat infamously, Sir Harry Gibbs, formerly a Chief Justice, speaking at an event hosted by the right-leaning Samuel Griffith Society some years ago, argued that if society is tolerant and rational, it does not need a Bill of Rights. If it is not, no Bill of Rights will preserve it. George Pell, the Catholic Cardinal of Sydney, earlier this year warned, and I quote, "We don't have a culture war here in Australia in the way the United States does, but a bill or a charter of rights might help provoke one." Maybe he got both countries wrong in that part. Yesterday, indeed, the Federal Shadow Attorney General, Senator Brandis, dismissed the Attorney General's launch of the National Consultation Process on Human Rights as a waste of time, precisely because we are already, he viewed, adequately covered under Australian law. On the left, the Labour Party, certainly that of New South Wales, has long distrusted Bills of Rights initiatives for various reasons, including, and I've heard one MP proclaim this, being fearful of repeating in New South Wales the sham of the constitution of the former Soviet Union, which, as many of you know, has had a comprehensive and very eloquent catalogue of rights protections. And Bob Carr, the former Labour Premier and long-time vehement opponent to the Bill of Rights, and indeed he is one of the believers that will be swamped by lawyers, has continued his opposition up to today, recently warning that a shift in power from elected parliaments to unelected judges by a process of judicial creep is part of the Bill of Rights package. And I think Mr. Carr here was using creep as an active verb rather than a character assessment, but I can never be sure. Now, the breadth, if not depth, of this antipathy in the political sphere has been at the root of so many of the federal failures to enact a Bill of Rights, which in modern times number three, or three and a half if you include the 1988 mini Bill of Rights referendum. And all of these were incidentally introduced by Labour governments. Now, in the face of the political impasse, it is perhaps no surprise that rearguard actions have been sought in the courts. Adding to the few enumerated rights contained in the Constitution, the High Court, particularly under Sir Anthony Mason in the 80s and 90s, expanded, by way of implication, rights associated with, firstly, representative government, and secondly, the judicial power, as starkly stated in the Constitution in Chapter 3. More recently, Michael Kirby has been ploughing a fairly lonely human rights furrow on the court, not least in respect of arguing for the use of international human rights law, to which Australia is a party, as an aid to the interpretation of statutes, including the mother of all statutes, the Constitution. The uncompromising negative political responses in the 90s and the noughties to such perceived judicial activism has significantly retarded the Bill of Rights debate, at least at the Commonwealth level, and at least until now. Under the Howard government, human rights were demonised, UN human rights committees shunned, and financial support for rights bodies, including particularly the one we're sitting in today, withdrawn or slashed. Furthermore, liberal judgments in high-profile cases in the High Court, and I should also say also in the Federal Court, the Family Court, and in certain Supreme Courts, concerning such issues as Indigenous land rights, the mandatory detention of asylum seekers, children's rights, criminal justice and anti-terrorism laws, were criticised, often openly, by ministers, and their effects reversed by legislation. So, given all this jurisprudential carnage at the hands of the political barbarians, as some might have it, it is maybe surprising to find ourselves today in the situation where two Bills of Rights exist at the gubernatorial level, and three other states and territories are seriously considering the possibility. And of course, now, at the federal level, we have the newly launched Frank Brennan-headed national consultation process, as backed by the 2020 summit promises. Now, an audience such as this today in particular would likely be very well versed in the pros and the cons of the Bill of Rights debate. And in any case, Lord Bingham has just gone through very similar pros and cons in the United Kingdom, which will apply in very large measure to the Australian circumstance. So I don't intend to rehearse them here again, you'll be delighted to know. Rather, what I want to do is to stress two points of fundamental importance over which there is, I think, continuing confusion. And this is confusion that must be dispelled as we enter the new phase of Australia's flirtation with the Bill of Rights. The first point concerns the purpose of a Bill of Rights, and the second, the process of a Bill of Rights. So the purpose first. Human rights apply to us all, not just the marginalised. Now, this might seem trite, but it is a fundamental point, and it is too often overlooked. In this room, I wager, there are doubtless some of you who are, relatively speaking, fairly relaxed and comfortable with your own personal circumstances. Well, at least I sincerely hope there are. But there will also be some of you who are far from relaxed and comfortable with your lot. More aggravation and rage, as Powderfinger would put it. The legal protections of human rights, such as they are in Australia, are fundamentally relevant to both camps. This is my point. The aggravated, inside and outside this room, should and will try to utilise human rights laws to combat injustices, and thereby, of course, they will attract attention. The relaxed and comfortable are enjoying their state precisely because their human rights are well protected, and they have no need to attract attention by having publicly to claim them. Now, the essence of the Howard government's demonisation of human rights was to highlight only the first of that group and ignore or overlook the circumstances of the second group. Now, as our Bill of Rights debate moves forward, whatever the arguments for and against it, let it not be heard, I venture, that a Bill of Rights will just be a whinger's charter, irrelevant to mainstream Australia. This, in my view, is profane nonsense. If, above all, a Bill of Rights can educate about the nature and the fundamental importance of rights to the construction and maintenance of our systems of democratic governance and the rule of law, then it will have achieved much. So secondly, my second point on process. The dialogue model of Bill of Rights adopted by the United Kingdom, by Victoria and by the ACT, is one that is directed at all organs of government, not just the judiciary. This type of Bill of Rights has avenues for commentary and communication within and between all organs of government, each according to its authority. It is what my friend and colleague Conor Geraghty at the London School of Economics calls the aspiration of institutional competence. Judges are authorised to call in aid relevant international human rights law, and they can pronounce on the incompatibility or inconsistency of laws. Bureaucrats must prepare impact statements. Ministers must make statements of legislative compatibility or not. And ultimately, parliaments can override. So, as with the purpose, my first point, this sophisticated system of checks and balances, it's crucial to comprehend it in full. Indeed, it is, for me, the clincher for supporting this type of Bill of Rights. The express intention to engage and educate all parts and all levels of government is what democratises and legitimises such a Bill of Rights initiative. Parliamentarians, ministers and public servants are appropriately legalised under this system, and the judiciary is appropriately politicised, all in the realm of human rights. At least this is the theory. It is too early to make any meaningful assessments as to the extent of this viral impact through the governmental organs of Victoria and the ACT, but in the UK the results seem to be mixed over the longer time. The UK Parliament's Joint Committee on Human Rights, the establishment of which coincidentally was the subject of my doctoral thesis and indeed led indirectly to me emigrating to Australia 20 years ago, has conducted a number of reviews of the Human Rights Act. None of these is more revealing than those that have sought to gauge the penetration of the culture of human rights into the mainstream thinking and practices of government departments. At best, it might be considered incomplete. Some departments, for instance, the Department of Health, have made efforts to incorporate human rights perspectives into their policy-making processes and their implementation practices, especially, I might add, regarding mental health issues. But that has been largely prompted by a number of adverse court cases. But many departments have not done anything like this. And even in health, it was noted by the committee that officials viewed the measures that they were being asked to comply with as more bureaucratic hurdles that had to be cleared rather than as aids to better policy making and practice. Communications between the Joint Committee and the ministers seem to have been more robustly successful, even if the parties agree to disagree. And the relationship between Parliament and the judiciary has also been relatively successful. That is, the relationship forged by judicial declarations of incompatibility and the response of Parliament to those declarations, most of which, incidentally, have been accepted. Not all, but most have been accepted. So the lesson to be learnt is perhaps that the building of a human rights culture is like Rome, not done in a day. And yet, it is of vital importance. In giving evidence to the Joint Committee on Human Rights in 2006, Harriet Harman, who was then the Minister of Constitutional Affairs, acknowledged as much, and she stated that it was the government's intention to take human rights beyond policymakers, lawyers, and the courts. In light of the continuing concerns, including from inside the United Kingdom government, over the Human Rights Act's fitness for purpose in its present form, we in Australia need to be mindful of how long the human rights road is likely to be. We must be aware that the enactment of a Bill of Rights is not the end of the process, but in fact only the beginning. Let me finish this brief comment with a quote not from the United Kingdom or from the Australian cauldrons of the debate, but from David Kennedy of Harvard Law School. Reflecting upon the nature of human rights laws, Kennedy has remarked that the ambivalent porosity is their secret strength. Sure, we do need robust, highly competent and committed judges like Lord Bingham to arbitrate the disputes that such laws will inevitably spawn. But we also need legislatures, executives, public services, and the wider community to engage in the process if we are to understand and to unearth and to bring to bear that secret strength. So here's hoping that the Human Rights Debate Roadshow, which will be coming soon to a venue near you, will deliver on these aims. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David, for that helpful drawing together of the issues around an English or United Kingdom and Australian Human Rights Act, and giving us that context. Now we have time for some questions. We've got some roving microphones. I would ask people to wait for the microphone before you ask a question, and if you can just start with your name and perhaps where you're from, so that we. We know it just helps to answer the questions, gives them a bit more context. I have to admit in this process that I've got a very serious behavioural fault, and that is that if you put your hand up to ask a question, I'll ignore you completely. But we've got people with a microphone, so we'll come round and indicate. So do we have a first question? It was the hardest one to find, is the first question.
Is it on?
Yes, it is.
Not so hard, Graham.
No.
Robin Banks from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. I'm really interested in exploring how much difference it makes having Strasbourg, because of course we don't. And I think that really creates a big question about how effective what is called the dialogic model would be in Australia. Without that backstop, that means Parliament might as well pay attention to judgments under the UK Act, because if they don't, they're just going to be potentially dragged into Strasbourg. So just, I guess, your views about how critical that backstop is in the UK.
Said, I think, that I questioned whether the United Kingdom would have given domestic effect to the European Convention had it not been for the existence of Strasbourg. But virtually anything which is a breach of the European Convention would also be a breach of the ICCPR. So the same international obligation to put the matter right would exist in the one case as in the other. I think it affects, as it were, the political pressure to act, but I don't think it affects the legal obligation to do so.
I just might say, Robin, that I suppose the positive political spin on it is to say you want to have your human rights determinations, a point that Lord Bingham made strongly in his presentation, at home. And even if going to the Human Rights Committee is not as arduous and doesn't produce such authoritative results as you get from Strasbourg, it nevertheless is embarrassing. Well, at least for governments that care. And if you have governments that care, then they'll want to do what the name of the white paper that Lord Bingham was referring to is: you want to bring rights home, you want to have them determined here. So I think that's probably the line that we'll say, should we want to do this here? You know, we don't want this to go off, even if it's occasionally, we don't want it to go off to Geneva or New York.
Other question?
Hi, I'm Libby. I attended a lecture about 2 months ago where the professor was talking about when a human rights act is introduced, you then end up with a situation where human rights are then balanced against other rights, economic rights, etc. I wonder if you could comment on the experience in the UK and if there is any examples that you might want to talk about that show where a human right is in some ways devalued is the wrong term to use, but because it's balanced against other rights, it's no longer necessarily fundamental. So
I referred, I think, to the principle which Strasbourg has insisted on, that inherent in the whole of the convention is a balance between the rights of the individual and the rights of the community. And I think that time and again one has cases in which you have to say, well, we know what this particular complainant wants, but how does this fit into a bigger picture? Perhaps I can give one example. I recall a case concerning dress at a school for Muslim girls. And from the point of view of the complainant, it was an extraordinarily bad test case, because it was a school in which a great majority of the pupils were Muslim, a majority of the governors of the school were Muslim, and the headmistress was Muslim. And they had gone to enormous lengths to consult the Muslim Council of Great Britain and the imams locally and elsewhere as to what was the appropriate dress for an adolescent Muslim girl in order to reflect the requirement that the female figure should be to some extent as it were disguised, and having gone through all this process of consultation, they devised a school uniform which was optional but which anybody who wanted to could wear. The particular complainant, her elder sister, went through the school absolutely no problem. Then her father died. A very aggressive 19-year-old brother became the head of the family, and he said that this uniform that his sister was wearing wouldn't do, and she had to wear some more discreet garment still, and made a terrific row about this and said he was going to take the headmistress to court, etc., etc., which was exactly what he did. Now, there was within this school a considerable division of opinion, because while this girl's brother was agitating for her to be permitted to wear this garment called a jilbab, as I recall. The other pupils were dead against it. They saw this as the first step into in a competition as to who could be more Islamic than the next person, and they were terrified they were all going to end up sort of wearing burqas and so on with the most extreme manifestation of dress uniformity, which they simply did not want. So it did present. She complained, of course, that her right to manifest her religious belief was being infringed, but there were considerations on the other side which led us to conclude that she had no legitimate complaint. So I'm giving that rather lengthy example. I think it illustrates the point, I hope it illustrates the point, that one is trying to achieve a sort of harmonious balance.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Pam Pemberton. I'm from the Intellectual Disability Rights Service. But the question that I'm putting to the panel today doesn't really concern the rights of people with intellectual disability, but rather it's an issue of... I'm seeking the comments of both panellists in relation to Section 26 of the Australian Constitution, that the people of any race other than the Aboriginal race in any state for whom it is deemed necessary to make special laws, that particular section allows the Commonwealth Government to basically discriminate against people in relation to race, which if anyone understands anything about genetics knows that there's no such thing as a particular race, and this particular section of the Constitution confirms for me that to enact a subordinate act rather than effect constitutional change, which would be subject to the historically observed whims and fantasies of political parties to change the amendments that we make to human rights within legislation and common law, that particular section, for me, shows quite clearly that until such time as the Constitution is amended in this country and the rights that we are all seeking for both groups, both the satisfied and the dissatisfied, cannot really be met by an act which is subject to the transient whims and fantasies of political change. So please, may I have your comments in relation to the merits of either enacting constitutional change or subordinate legislation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lord Bingham, for just handing that over to me. but that seems fair enough. I mean, the questioner goes right to the nub of a big part of the Bill of Rights debate, isn't it? You know, whether we go for the constitutional amendment or whether we go for an ordinary statute. Now, Britain, in a way, didn't have that concern because it didn't have a constitution, but yet the bill, the act, has obtained a level of importance that does set it apart. You hinted at it, Lord Bingham, but it probably does set it apart, like the European Communities Act and certain other acts which are not constitutionally established, but yet they have a degree of political inscrutability. They may be amended, but to get rid of them would be extraordinary. I think the way to approach your question, though, is to ask, what are you going to get out of this and how are you going to achieve it? We have an appalling record of getting amendments to the Constitution through. 48 amendments have been put up and we've got 8 through. I remember Michael Kirby once saying that the way in which to get it through in the Australian populace is just to couch the question in the negative, because everyone will just go no and there you'll get it through. And I thought that was marvellous. I think Kirby missed his vocation. Should have been a politician. He is a politician, but so I think the constitutional line is not going to go through. But is that a disaster? I don't necessarily think so. And again, this is maybe where Lord Bingham might want to come in. You know, you just have to trust. I agree you can have bad politicians and and they can do bad things, but it does require them all, or at least a majority of them, to work together. And yes, you can have things that are on the margins that are maybe even more than the margins are seen as discriminatory and racially discriminatory. But the political process stabilized or undergirded by legally protected human rights, even at an ordinary statutory level, is a solid, robust way in which to approach these things. It may not always achieve the outcome that you want or that I want, but it is a way forward using both politics and law. And I don't think we need to despair if that sort of result is a political milieu that you obtain, rather than getting a sort of king hit constitutional amendment type circumstance. The United States human rights protection record is in many ways not as good as ours, and yet it has amendments that are part of the Constitution and constitutionally protected. Would
you like to? Well, I can't say anything useful about Section 26 of the Australian Constitution, but I do think that Article 14 of the European Convention does its work. It specifies a series of grounds upon which there may be no discrimination in the enjoyment of convention rights, but ends up by saying, or other status. So the list that is given is not comprehensive. And there's been some debate and some difficulty in defining what will fall within the description, all other status. But I think the current view is that it covers any characteristic peculiar to an individual. There are those who think you should have an absolutely freestanding anti-discrimination provision, which the convention does not. It only applies to discrimination in the enjoyment of a convention right. But I don't myself think there's much wrong with the provision as it stands.
Thank you. We've got time for one or two more very quick questions before we draw things to a close.
I'm a law student. I'm interested in what the long-term impact of a Human Rights Act would have on the common law, particularly if it were to be repealed, as some seem to be advocating in the UK. Does it become embedded? And if it's repealed, does it stay there?
Although I think that the Human Rights Act could certainly be repealed, I'm not at all confident that one could put the genie back in the bottle as easily as all that. And I think that having had the experience of a framework by which to judge things, the courts would find it extremely difficult simply to say, well, we don't have that anymore. So I don't know really what would happen quite if it were repealed. There is a division of view as to whether the common law should seek to sort of keep in step with the jurisprudence under the Human Rights Act and the Strasbourg jurisprudence. I myself sort of think it should, and I would think it absurd. For example, I gave the example of the case called X against Bedfordshire County Council, absurd if the common law were to go on saying there is no duty of care in this situation, when people then go to Strasbourg and win huge damages. And that doesn't seem to make very good sense to me.
One more final question. We've got one.
I should perhaps say that not all my former colleagues would agree with what I said.
One of that.
I was just interested in the panellists' views on the court's role in dealing with economic, social and cultural rights as opposed to civil and political rights.
Yeah, well, I mean, this has obviously been a big issue. Another of my former colleagues, Keith Ewing, is active advocate of economic, social and cultural rights being included, and they have been included in other countries. I mean, South Africa is obviously the most obvious example of that, but they are also derivatively covered by the sorts of civil and political rights that, indeed, the last example that's now twice been brought up by Lord Bingham on the Bedfordshire County Council, that's about the right to health care, in effect, for these children. So a decision that is made on the basis of a rule of law notion, the idea that the court should, that somebody should have a redress for a bad decision, a poor administrative decision made, in this case, by a county council, leads to directly to an economic benefit, that is, that other children would hopefully not be put in this circumstance, although recently it's happened again. So it's not as if just having a European Convention of Human Rights incorporation means that economic, social and cultural rights are not therefore affected. They may not be expressly included, but they are going to be affected by the ways in which these civil and political rights are interpreted. Whether you go so far as to put economic, social and cultural rights in, I mean, we don't have the United Kingdom nor Australia, we don't have the political flux that the South Africans have in order to pour some new mold, create some new mold and pour in a new policy. That's what happened there, and that's how they could do that. We don't have anything like that, and nor did the United Kingdom in 1998.
I agree with respect to what's just been said. I think there are some rights which one can regard as core rights, and almost anybody would think they needed to be protected, the right to life, the right not to be tortured, the right to liberty, etc., etc. The further you get from those core rights, in a sense, the more difficult they become. And I think, for example, the right to education, which is a right in one of the protocols, the European Convention, is very tentatively expressed. It does not give everyone, everywhere in Australia, the right to go to the University of Sydney and study Sanskrit. What it gives is a right to participate fairly in such education as is on offer in the state in which you live. And it would be quite hard in an instrument that applies to countries in varying degrees of development to have anything very much tougher than that. And the same, I think, is true of something like the right to work. We all, no doubt, think it's extremely important for a whole series of obvious reasons that people should be able to work and earn a living if they want to. But, for example, in a time of recession like the present, people do lose their jobs, and therefore the right to have a job and to work can't really be as hard-edged, I don't think, as the right to be tortured. Of course, advance arguments about the need to support people if they haven't got a job, but that's quite a different thing from actually having a right to work. So I'm not at all disparaging these rights or suggesting they're unimportant or don't contribute to human happiness and fulfillment and so on. I'm just suggesting that the further you get from the hardest sort of core rights, in a sense, the more difficult they become to recognise and enforce.
Well, thank you, Lord Bingham. I'm sure that David Kinley, as a chair at Sydney University, is pleased that people don't have the right to study Sanskrit there. Might be a bit challenging for the availability of courses. But please join me again in thanking our speakers for today's seminar.